Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature entitled An Enduring Strength. Founded in the year 1909 to foster a new image and confidence among Jews in Vienna, the Hakoah Sports Club flourished before being decimated under Nazi rule. Today, the club and its spirit are vital again. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer L. John Wertheim. It doesn't look like much from the outside, one of several health clubs studding a long street running beside the Danube, deep in Vienna's second district. Clean and unstuffy, the place comes with the typical gym trappings, pools, fitness rooms, tennis courts, a workout area. Walk in on a random Monday and girls are playing dodgeball in the gym while boys shoot hoops behind them. In the workout room, a half dozen adults listen to their podcasts on earbuds as Harry Styles wafts from the speakers. A lost and found bin is overstuffed with unclaimed towels and T-shirts and swim goggles, all of which is to say the Hakoah Sports Club in the heart of Grand Vienna, it does a convincing impersonation of your local YMCA. Like most of the members inside, the place tries strenuously to conceal its age. It advertises state-of-the-art equipment. To attract younger members, there are hot student rates of roughly $45 a month. But then there's a small off-to-the-side hallway lined with trophy cases filled with ribbons and certificates and medals and black and white photos. Near the exit, there's a small sign that most members surely pass without notice. The sign reads, Hakoah Bis 1909. Translation, Hakoah from 1909. If you were going to comb through history for the period and place with the densest concentration of intellect and furious creativity, you couldn't do much better than the beginning of 20th century Vienna. In one pocket of town, bearded and bespectacled Sigmund Freud was holding forth on the outsized role of dreams and the subconscious in human psychology. In another, Gustav Klimt and the rebellious secession movement artists were challenging the norms of conventional art, marrying paint with materials like gold leaf. The progressive composer and conductor Gustav Mahler directed the Vienna Court Opera, not far from the studio of the radical musical innovator Arnold Schoenberg. Journalist and activist Theodor Herzl was developing his vision of political Zionism, while Martin Buber and Ludwig Wittgenstein debated philosophy. Franz Kafka was drafting his earliest stories, and Stefan Zweig was publishing his first novels. in what was less a city than a laboratory of ideas, thousands upon thousands led lives of the mind. Writers, architects, composers, professors, poets, artists. By night and often by day, they would gather in salons and cafes, exchanging theories, books, sometimes artwork. Fresh thoughts and creative outputs were the city's dual currencies. Meanwhile, another towering Viennese figure of the time was trumpeting brains under brawn. Max Nordau was encouraging the city's 200,000 Jewish residents, a full 10% of the local population, to put down their books and instead pick up some weights. At the 1898 Zionist Congress, Nordau seized on the term, quote-unquote, muscular Judaism. His theory, improving power, agility, conditioning, and discipline, would lead to a stronger and more physically assured Jew who would outshine the long-held stereotype of the weak, intellectually sustained Jew, unquote. You can imagine the regulars in the Vienna Cafe stroking their chins. Very interesting. Nordau believed that a physical culture would serve as pushback to anti-Semitism, a counter to the increasingly frequent mocking caricatures and propaganda. This was an urgent concern, as anti-Jewish bias, while always a blight throughout Europe in varying degrees, was picking up at the time. And not least in Vienna, where Karl Luger, the city's populist mayor from 1897 until his death in 1910, was a flagrant bigot who desired liberation for Christians from what he termed, quote, the shameful shackles of servitude to the Jews, unquote. Also around the same time, a shiftless would-be artist had relocated to Vienna from his hometown of Linz, and deeply influenced by Luger, he too began trafficking in Jew-bashing tropes. Adolf Hitler turned 20 in the year 1909, but he was already deep in conspiracy mode. That same year, two Viennese men founded an athletic club open to the city's Jews. Ignaz Hermann Körner, a prominent dentist, and Fritz Lerner Bethe, a soccer enthusiast who was by that point a leading opera librettist, were inspired by Nordau. They were also inspired by the so-called Aryan Clause, laws which permitted Austrians to ban Jews from organizations and institutions. The two men named their new club Hakoa, from the Hebrew word for strength or power. Advertised as, quote-unquote, a Jewry of muscles, Hakoa started as a social club in search of sweat. Like so much in Europe, its growth was stunted by World War I. But steadily, Hakoa added competitive teams and in less than a decade became a magnet, attracting sports-minded Jews from Vienna and then other Austrian towns. When athletes from Hakoa competed against other clubs in Austria, they wore jerseys embroidered with a Jewish star, a source of pride and identity. And as Hakoa's teams began winning, membership roles grew, which enabled Hakoa to field even more competitive teams. As one member put it decades later, quote, it was like a folk tale. The greater the success, the more people wanted to join, unquote. There were Hakoa teams in wrestling, track and field, fencing, tennis, and swimming. Then came hockey, table tennis, even ski tourism. At its peak, Alcoa's general membership surpassed 5,000, making it one of the largest sports clubs in Europe. But above all, Alcoa had established itself as a soccer powerhouse. The program started as a glorified pickup team, recreational players kicking a ball around in Vienna parks. Within a few years, Alcoa had a budget to pay for both facilities and talent, sometimes poaching players from Hungary and Czechoslovakia. The club leased a field for its games near the Vienna Prater, drawing upwards of 20,000 fans, including Kafka. Between the years 1910 and 1920, Alcoa ascended from Austria's fourth division to the first. In 1921, the club finished fourth in the country. The next year, Alcoa finished second. If there was one game that defined the club, it was the third to last of the 2024-2025 season. With a record of 9 wins, 5 losses, 3 ties, Alcoa faced off against Wiener Athletisport Club in a game that would ultimately decide the season championship. With the score tied 2-2, Hakoa's goalkeeper, Alexander Fabian, went up for a challenge and broke his arm while he collided with the opposition striker. Whether the play was dirty or not depends on the retelling. At the time, in Austria, as in most European soccer leagues, substitutions were not permitted. So Fabian placed his arm in a makeshift sling and switched positions with a teammate. With less than 10 minutes left in the game, the ball landed before the feet of Fabian, now a striker. Instinctively, he torqued his foot and fired a shot towards the goal. The ball was deflected, improbably, and found the back of the net. Alcoa held on to win 3-2, the erstwhile goalkeeper scoring the winning goal. Then, as now in soccer, greater success begets greater spending. With more fans and thus more revenue, Alcoa could afford superior talent. The club's championship roster featured 3 of Austria's best professional players: Max Gold, Max Grunwald, and Josef Eisenhofer. In his excellent 2004 book entitled How Soccer Explains the World, journalist Franklin Foer writes of Alcoa, quote, "Based on all the evidence we have, the Jewish Stars were, for a short spell, one of the best teams on the planet," unquote. The victories set off wild, exultant celebrations, especially in Vienna's second district, where most of the city's Jewish population resided. One commentator asserted, quote, "Jewish dignity and Jewish self-confidence are in good hands now," unquote. But any Alcoa triumph inevitably came accompanied by a spasm of the anti-Semitism flaring up throughout so much of Europe. Especially following World War I, Austria was a country in need of a scapegoat on which to pin the defeat and demise of the Habsburg Empire. The Jews were the easy mark. The successful, prominent Jewish soccer team was an easier mark still. So it was that Alcoa would seldom get through a game without an anti-Semitic slur and a fight. The aggression and the violence often were framed as rivalry, but to the club it represented something much darker. And it wasn't just the men on the field who were targeted. In 1923, Körner, the Alcoa co-founder and president, was attacked by an opposing player. Alcoa fans got it worse, regularly being spat upon, beaten, and pelted with rocks and other objects. Hakoa responded by enlisting the club's wrestling team as its security detail, protecting fans, players, and coaches from the aggressive opposing clubs who unabashedly saw Jews as less than. It was a different story outside of continental Europe. Word spread about this unlikely soccer dynamo, winning despite the hostile environments. And in the early 1920s, Hakoa embarked on a series of international tours, at once performing as heroes, not villains, fattening the club's balance sheets, and spreading the gospel of muscular Judaism. In terms of both match results and splintering stereotypes, these marches outside of Austria were wildly successful. After Hakoa's odyssey through Germany in 1924, the Munich-based sports paper named Fussball commented that, quote, Hakoa had helped to do away with the fairy tale about the physical inferiority of Jews, unquote. A year earlier, the Hakoa soccer team had taken a series of trains and boats and ended up in the UK to take on West Ham United, the FA Cup runner-up that year. Hakoa prevailed 5-1, believed to be the first foreign team to win a game on British soil. The team also won against clubs like Slavia Prague, the first time in more than a decade that the premier Czech club was beaten on home soil, and against opponents as far away as Africa. In 1926, Hakoa embarked on a U.S. tour, a series of matches played before almost a quarter of a million fans overall, including 46,000 at New York's Polo Grounds, then a record for an American soccer game. During the tour, the club was even received by President Calvin Coolidge at the White House. At the time, the New York Times stressed the Barnstormers' stylish play, noting, quote, the manner in which the Hakoa players used their heads to bounce the ball to each other made it plain that soccer is no game for a bald man or one wearing a derby hat, unquote. Pinballing around the East Coast, Hakoa won 6 games, drew 2, and lost 2. There were occasional adventures. At one point, the team boarded the wrong New York train and ended up lost in East Orange, New Jersey. But the players were embraced by American crowds for what they represented, hailed as they were as, quote, the pride of European Jewry, unquote, but even more so for how they performed on the pitch. Reporting on the Hakoa tour, a June 1927 editorial in the Times began with a bold claim, one that has been repeated many times since, quote, a taste for soccer is no longer a social error. The game has arrived. In time, a seat at a soccer game may even represent a certain amount of social distinction, unquote. The embrace was mutual. The Hakoa stars were enthralled by America with its freedoms, its excesses, and its general absence of overt anti-Semitism. Offered contracts to play for various American teams, 9 of the 11 players stayed in the States. Bringing to bear their free-flowing and creative style, many were held up as pioneers, blazing new trails for American soccer with what the Times called an intricate, prearranged system of passing, noting that soccer is a game which requires the footwork of a danseuse, unquote. Hakoa's biggest star, Bela Gutman, decamped to the Brooklyn Wanderers and would go on to coach teams throughout the world until the 1970s. Erno Schwartz stayed in the U.S. to play for the New York Giants, founded the New York Americans in 1931 and in 1953 was named coach of the U.S. men's national team. Fabian, the goalie who broke his arm but scored the winning goal in the 1925 title-clinching game, played for the New York Giants in the American Soccer League and then for a team called the New York Hakoa. Back in Vienna, its roster depleted, Hakoa went into rebuild mode. In 1928, just 3 years removed from its pinnacle moment winning the Austrian championship, Hakoa was relegated. The club was promoted in the early 1930s, but it would be relegated again in 1937 after winning just once in 22 games. An anti-Semitic arson attack on the Hakoa sports field also impeded progress. As the Hakoa soccer program struggled, both the club and its followers fixated on another sport. In the mid-1920s, more than 500,000 Austrian residents flocked to the capital for the annual Kur durch Wien, Across Vienna Festival, featuring swimming, diving, and rowing events held along the Danube. The contests were open to all residents, male or female, regardless of age, experience, or faith. In a canal of the Danube, right off the famous ring encircling Vienna's city center, it was hard not to notice the heavy concentration of swimmers from one club. In 1925, 18-year-old breaststroker Hedy Bienenfeld pulled out a dramatic win in the 7.5-kilometer river competition. The following year, Bienenfeld placed second with Fritzi Lowry, just 15 years old, swimming freestyle and taking first. Both were members of Hakoa, and steadily a swimming dynasty was underway. In the late 20s, Tsigo Wertheimer, Hakoa's swim coach and director of swimming, Valentin Rosenfeld, a former lawyer, spun off the aquatics club and worked to transform Hakoa into an aquatic dynamo. They scoured Austria's smaller towns for prospects. The team practiced and often competed in Vienna's Amalienbad, a swank Art Deco swimming pavilion. In the summer, they trained at the famed Dianabad. In the winter, the pool was boarded over and the Dianabad became a concert hall that, in 1867, housed the first public performance of Johann Strauss's waltz, Blue Danube. Wertheimer, in particular, could be a hard ass, not above throwing his shoes into the water when his swimmers lapsed in energy or attention. Pressed on his methods, he reasoned that he would do the same if male athletes were sloughing off. Why would women be different? This emphasis on and investment in women's sports was all in keeping with the times, and then again, not. In some ways, Vienna was blazingly progressive. Women were finally becoming artists and musicians. Why, for the first time, could they not become dedicated competitive athletes, too? But there was also a cultural split, as Vienna was still steeped in traditional values. One example of many, Gustav Mahler's wife Alma was a gifted composer in her own right, but after their wedding, he demanded that she forsake her musicianship as it distracted her from her chief responsibility, catering to his needs. No matter, Wertheimer and Rosenfeld and hundreds of swimmers persisted. During summers, there were months-long training blocks in the Austrian countryside where, for hours, the swimmers would carve up the waters of Lake Werthersee. In the poignant 2004 documentary entitled Watermarks, 1930s Hakoa swimmer Anne-Marie Pisker recalls training sessions in the resort town of Portsach. Quote, it was swimming and training, training and swimming, unquote. Wertheimer and Rosenfeld were meticulous in planning regimens and practices. In an early nod to analytics, they enlisted statisticians to help build a data-driven approach. They also leaned on dietitians and local scientists, one of whom asserted that, contrary to popular belief at the time, females did not have to take to their bed while menstruating. In Austria's equivalent of the American Roaring Twenties or libertine Weimar Germany, some of the Hakoa swimmers became cause celebs in the culture at large. They drank, they smoked, they openly dated other women. When she was not winning swimming competitions, Bienefeld, beautiful and not lacking in self-confidence, was moonlighting as a fashion and swimsuit model for Vienna's leading magazines, often with a cigarette burning between her fingers. After taking a series of lovers, both male and female, Bienenfeld in 1930 married Wertheimer, a mentor 10 years her senior. Lowy, meanwhile, allegedly carried on an affair with Wertheimer's partner, Rosenfeld, the director of the Hakoa Swimming Division, whose psychoanalyst wife, Eva Rosenfeld, was a member of the inner circle of Anna Freud, Sigmund's daughter. As with Hakoa's soccer program in the 1910s and 1920s, success was infectious. Younger girls watched older girls in the water and pleaded with their parents to enroll them in the club. If they had to take multiple trolleys to get to the pools, so be it. When swimmers like Lowy and Bienenfeld aged out, a new generation was there to replace them. Ruth Langer began swimming seriously at Hakoa as an 11-year-old, mostly because it was an area where she could eclipse her older brother, an intellectual who was not athletically inclined. By the age of 14, she had smashed the Austrian record in both the 100 and 400-meter freestyle. In an iron-sharpens-iron kind of way, she swam alongside Judith Deutsch, who set 12 national records in 1 year and received Austria's Golden Badge, the country's highest athletic award. In 1935, the second Maccabi Games, the Jewish Olympics, were held in Tel Aviv. While 1,300 athletes from 28 countries competed, Austria's entire delegation came from Hakoa. In Watermarks, Piska remembers the trip, traversing the Mediterranean aboard an ocean liner adorned with pools and decks. At night, Tsigo used to chase us around the ship to get us to go back to our cabins, Bisker says. We didn't want to sleep. We wanted to stay on deck and dance and talk. We had a lovely time, unquote. Led by the women swimmers, Austria won 18 medals, the most of any country that year. Though Austrian swimming officials were not inclined to select Jews, three Hakoa athletes, Langer, Deutsch, and Lucy Goldner, qualified for the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. By this point, Hitler was in power, and anti-Semitism was in the open throughout Austria. When Hakoa swimmers prepared for the games, it meant disobeying a sign affixed to the pool that was reading, "No entry for dogs and Jews." Shortly before the opening ceremony, at the behest of the World Federation of Jewish Sports Clubs, headed by Lord Melchett of Great Britain, the three Hakoa swimmers declined to take part in the Olympics. In a statement, they explained, quote, we do not boycott Olympia, but Berlin, unquote. How, they reasoned, could they compete at what would be a Third Reich pageant, a glorified pep rally for Nazism. In response to the boycott, the Austrian Swimming Association banned the three swimmers for life, quote, due to severe damage of Austrian sports, unquote, and stripped them of their national titles. In Watermarks, Deutsch's sister Hani, another Hakoa swimmer, says she thinks of Judith as the first person to say no to Hitler. But as Austria lurched even further to the political right, the swimmers had no recourse as Jewish individuals, nor did Hakoa as a Jewish institution. Besides, within barely a year, unfulfilled swimming potential, lost soccer games, and expunged national records would be the least of the worries of the Hakoa community. By the late 1930s, Hitler and the Third Reich were in full genocide mode. The March 1938 Anschluss marked Germany's annexation of Austria. It was a maybe the pivotal event in the lead-up to World War II. While most Austrians welcomed the Nazi takeover, it ended whatever old-world charm and civility and cosmopolitan cafe culture that had persisted. Quote-unquote, Venus Austria, Freud famously wrote in his diary. World-famous, cancer-stricken Dr. Freud escaped to England. He was, in a sense, lucky. Other, quote-unquote, non-Aryans were rounded up or deported or tortured at Hotel Metropole, where the Gestapo headquartered in Vienna. Some were sent to forced labor camps. Some were executed in front of City Hall. The Nazis, unsurprisingly, had Hakoa in their crosshairs. 3 days into the Anschluss, the Gestapo raided and ransacked the Hakoa offices. Where better to find names and addresses of the city's Jewish residents? The swim division president, Rosenfeld, was atop the Gestapo's most wanted list. The Nazis seized Hakoa's assets and real estate. A March 17, 1938 headline in the Jewish weekly Selbstwehr read, quote, Hakoa dissolved, unquote. As the Nazi noose tightened, each week seemed to bring a new humiliation or a new referendum that reduced rights. For nearly three decades, the Hakoa athletes had proudly worn the Jewish star as a club logo on their uniforms and swimsuits. Overnight, they were forced to wear a yellow Jewish star sewn on their clothes every time they left home. According to Adolf Eichmann, it was to identify them as quote-unquote impure, and it was often a prelude to their deportation to death camps. Just as the club was erased, soon, too, were its members. The soccer team that had been the toast of the world a decade before? Max Schorr, the longtime and well-regarded captain who led the team to the West Ham triumph, fled Austria for France. Apprehended by the Nazis while attempting to reach Switzerland, he was executed. So were former players Oskar Grogsgrun, Ernst Horowitz, Josef Kolisch, Oskar Pollock, and Ali Schoenfeld, as was the club's co-founder, the libertist Fritz Lohner-Bethe. Sent to Auschwitz, Lohner-Bethe was deemed by a guard to be working insufficiently hard, so he was beaten to death. The club that had produced 18 Austrian Olympians between 1909 and 1936 was smashed. Soccer coach Arthur Barr managed to escape to Palestine, where he documented the deaths of Hakoa athletes. He counted at least 38, which paled in comparison to the club's loyal fan base, thousands of whom had been sent to the gas chambers and systematically slaughtered. Others were more fortunate. All of the Hakoa soccer players who had chosen to stay in the U.S. during the barnstorming tour survived. Langer, the teenage swim prodigy, dyed her black hair blonde, began carrying a concocted baptismal certificate, and escaped to England. In 1939, 3 years after she boycotted the Berlin Olympics, she remained a formidable swimmer, winning the British long-distance championship win on the Thames. Another Hakoa swimming star, Alisheva Suits, was on the Austrian team that competed in the 1935 Maccabi Games in Tel Aviv. She returned home speaking effusively about wanting to live in a Jewish homeland free of prejudice. Her parents ridiculed the idea. 3 years later, after the family business was set ablaze, it was her ties with Hakoa and Tel Aviv that enabled the family to abscond on a ship and settle in what would become Israel. As she put it flatly in watermarks, quote, "I saved their lives," unquote. Then there were Rosenfeld and Wertheimer. Though their access to so many records of Viennese Jews made them top Nazi targets, they both managed to escape Austria. Rosenfeld made it to England. By one account, the Nazis arrived at his home, found him and his family missing, and shot the family dog out of frustration. Wertheimer and his wife Hetty, the former It Girl, made it to England and then New York, where they became U.S. citizens. From the safety of their new homes, Wertheimer and Rosenfeld worked tirelessly to save Hakoa members, spiriting them out of Europe. Wertheimer helped coordinate forged documents and visas. In 1943, the University of Vienna revoked Rosenfeld's doctoral degree in law, deeming him, quote, "unworthy as a Jew to hold an academic degree from a German university," unquote. But he used his contacts as well as his familiarity with immigration law to deliver athletes to safety, often encouraging other countries' federations to sponsor potential future Olympians. Through Rosenfeld, one former swimmer, Greta Stanton, secured a scholarship to Cambridge. Through Hakoa, Trude Hirschler, then a 17-year-old breaststroker, was able to get her family aboard a so-called quote-unquote illegal ship headed to Haifa. Thanks to Hakoa connections, Judith Deutsch, one of the swimmers who boycotted the Berlin Olympics, also ended up in what is now Israel. By at least one estimate, Rosenfeld and Wertheimer together saved more than 100 Hakoa athletes and their families, matching them with opportunities and sanctuary. "It was amazing," Deutsch said shortly before her death in 2004. "Together, they saved all the swimmers," unquote. From the safety of his home in London, Rosenfeld also continued his role publishing the Hakoa newsletter. Before the war, it had been a prosaic account of upcoming events, news, and dues updates. During the war, it turned into something much more profound. The subtext, "We may be scattered, but we remain connected." One entry read, quote, "Dear Hakoa members, I hope you are all well and feel welcome in your new countries. These are difficult times, but let us hope this newsletter can help us maintain our feeling of togetherness," unquote. On April 13, 1945, Nazi Vienna fell to the Soviet Army. By then, the city was a husk of itself. So many of the Baroque buildings had been ravaged, including the Dianabad Swimming Palace and Concert Hall. The Danube Canal water had turned brown from rubble and bomb fragments. The city's propulsive energy and creativity had been drained. The population had changed as well. Vienna officials estimate that the city's Jewish population had been 170,000 in 1938. 7 years later, it was 7,000. Tens of thousands had relocated. Tens of thousands had been killed. When the few Holocaust survivors did return to Vienna, they were greeted with something less than warmth. Though Austria offered no opposition or resistance to the 1938 Nazi annexation, after the war, the national position distilled to, quote, "Don't blame us. We were the first country Germany invaded," unquote. When the returning Jews attempted to reclaim their property, often they were rebuffed. Jewelry and arts and books that had been seized went unreturned. Rosenfeld had amassed a library of 3,000 to 4,000 rare and autographed books, which the Gestapo confiscated and stored at the Central Depot for seized Jewish collections. It took decades for him to get them back. In 1945, Hakoah attempted a reset. Though it no longer had a physical space, the Hakoah soccer program reformulated. But after 4 seasons in Austria's second division, the club struggled to draw crowds and win games. In 1949, it folded. With some success, other sports programs began to form again. Shuttling among Vienna's pools, the swim program started up, then water polo, judo, tennis. Hakoah was never going to be what it was, a sports powerhouse, says Daniel Fuchs, currently a Vienna entrepreneur whose grandfather, Karl Haber, was a Hakoah water polo player in the 1930s before escaping to Switzerland. But there was no expectation of that, he added. In time, more of the Hakoah sports stars of the 1920s and 30s returned to Vienna. Hedy and Tsigo Wertheimer, the swimming diva and her coach, ran a successful real estate business in Florida. When Tsigo died in 1965, Hedy came back home. When Loewy fought breast cancer, Hedy helped to pay for her former teammate's treatments. Slowly, Austria began to reckon with the past. While it took nearly 60 years, in 1995, the Federation of Austrian Swimming Clubs lifted the ban imposed on the Hakoah swimmers who boycotted the 1936 Olympics. It also restored their records. The Federation president at the time wrote, quote, "When I learned in recent weeks that athletes who refused to serve as window dressing for the Hitler regime received a lifetime ban, I blushed with anger and shame. I am deeply ashamed of the decision taken at that time," unquote. 28 years later, Vienna confronted the legacy of Karl Luger, the former mayor who influenced Hitler and is generally cited as the first politician of his era to use naked anti-Semitism for political gain. A bronze statue of him in the center of the city had been the subject of the familiar debate over monuments. Rather than take the statue down or let it stand unadulterated, city officials reached an unusual compromise, tilting the statue 3.5 degrees to represent a shifted perspective and to convey the, quote, "sense of instability," unquote. Spearheaded by the U.S. State Department, the 2001 Claims Conference held Austria to account for its Holocaust-era ill-gotten gains. A $360 million fund was established to compensate eligible families. As part of the settlement, money was also set aside to fund institutions. Through this grant, Hakoah Vienna was reborn. The city allotted a space, construction crews went to work, and in the year 2008, the current facility opened. Almost 90 years after the original, this was and is a different club in a different time for a different Vienna. It is a monument to persistence. Open to both Jews and non-Jews, the club currently has 800 members, down considerably, of course, from the glory days of the 1920s. While the majority are there for a workout, the place still mints elite athletes. Aviva Holinsky, a top Austrian swimmer, is affiliated with HOKA. So is Stephen Hege, an Olympian judoka. She is Jewish. He is not. Today, the club stands as one of those places that knits together a community. There are movie nights and game nights. The master swimmers sometimes get together for beers after practice. Fuchs, the local entrepreneur whose grandfather was a water polo star in the 1930s, is now a club vice president. Provided he can raise the funds, he intends to hold a ceremony this fall, honoring the 100-year anniversary of the 1925 HOKA soccer team that won the Austrian national championship. History lurks in other ways. You will never see another fitness club with this level of security. Multiple guards out front. A metal detector at the entrance. Two sets of doors that must seal before visitors pass through. Some of this owes to attacks on Jews worldwide after October the 7th. Some to the ascendancy of the far-right Freedom Party with its Nazi roots. But more than that, HOKA's double-barreled security nods to the vagaries of human nature. Quote, "People are happy here. It's such a nice club. Jewish and non-Jewish, it's a community," says Fuchs. "But maybe you never know when things can change," unquote. There are happier legacies, too. Exiled from Austria in the 1930s and 40s, many HOKA athletes tried to replicate their old club in their new landing spots, sometimes as teams, sometimes as physical facilities, and sometimes without proper permission and clearance from the original Vienna club. There were HOKA soccer clubs in New York and San Francisco. Those who fled to Argentina opened Club Nautico HOKA in Buenos Aires. A franchise in Denmark once billed itself as, quote, "Scandinavia's largest Jewish sports organization," unquote. Founded in 1939 by refugees to Australia, HOKA Sydney fielded a periodically successful professional soccer team, growing its membership roles. Later this year, it will christen a new sporting, fitness, community, cultural, and social venue for generations to come, unquote. And the sweep of HOKA's history is still being unearthed. Friedrich Torberg played both soccer and water polo for HOKA in the 1930s. He was also a talented writer. One of his early novels, entitled Der Schuler Gerber, was inspired by the unlikely relationship between the glamorous HOKA swimmer Hedy Bienenfeld, on whom Torberg admitted a fierce, if unrequited, crush, and the swimming coach Ziggo Wertheimer. At the time of the Anschluss, Torberg escaped to France and was then sponsored by a Hollywood studio to come to the United States. After working as a screenwriter and then a correspondent for Time magazine, he returned to Vienna. While Torberg died in 1979, his writings and correspondences have been kept at the Austrian National Library. A researcher recently came across a 1944 letter that Torberg had written to HOKA's co-founder and president, in Yetz Kerner. It read in part, quote, "It was Hakoah that taught me the first concepts of Jewish sports, of Jewish attitude, and perhaps of Jewishness itself. All the problems that beset us, and not only since Hitler, look entirely different when you have grown up with the awareness and experience that Jews can also be winners," unquote. And again, this Sports Illustrated feature is entitled Hakoah Vienna. Decimated under Nazi rule, an Austrian club is relevant again. Written by Sports Illustrated writer L. John Wertheim. Turning now to Sports Illustrated's website for a more modern-day sports feature, the headline reads, "Thunder finally made it to the mountaintop with plans to stay after first NBA title." Oklahoma City's path was rocky through the years of losing skids and rebuilding seasons. Belief in the young core, headlined by MVP Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, could lead to a dynasty. And this Sports Illustrated feature is written by Chris Mannix. Dateline, Oklahoma City. As the confetti rained down from the Paycom Center rafters, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander embraced the one person that he knew appreciated a championship as much as he did. Sam Presti brought Gilgeous-Alexander to Oklahoma City in 2019, insisting the gangly 20-year-old be included in the Los Angeles Clippers trade for Paul George. The Thunder team president prioritized developing him, signed, drafted, and traded for players to complement him, and never stopped believing the team could win with him. As a delirious crowd celebrated Oklahoma City's first NBA championship, Gilgeous-Alexander and Presti hugged, acknowledging not just the title, but the journey that it took to get there. "We both just said, we made it to the mountaintop," Gilgeous-Alexander tells Sports Illustrated. "We earned it," unquote. "We prioritize winning," Gilgeous-Alexander said. "We don't prioritize anything else in this game. We want to win, and we want to win on the highest level. That looks like something new every night, every opponent, every arena. That's all we focused on this whole season, no matter if it was Game 1, Game 45, Game 105. We prioritized winning. Because we did so, we won on the highest level," unquote. The question was inevitable: what about next season? What the Thunder have built looks sustainable. Every player is under contract for next season. The books for now are clean. Most of the core of the team is 27 or younger. There will be another influx of young talent next season, led by Nikola Topic, the 2024 lottery pick who missed all of this season with a knee injury. "I haven't even thought that far ahead," Gilgeous-Alexander said. "But yeah, we definitely still have room to grow," unquote. Holmgren's career has been plagued by injuries, leading the Thunder to believe the stringy 7-1 forward is just scratching the surface on his potential. A nasty hip injury cost Holmgren 50 games this season, robbing him of the strength and conditioning that he needed to be at his best. Holmgren shot 43% from three-point land in the first quarters this season when his legs were fresh. In the fourth quarter, that number dipped to 25%. Oklahoma City will prioritize conditioning with Holmgren this summer. His trainer, Drew Hanlon, has already mapped out a plan to improve Holmgren's ability to score through contact and became a more versatile three-point shooter. Asked what level he expected Holmgren to rise to next season, Hanlon was succinct, quote-unquote, all-star. It isn't just Holmgren. In his third season, Jalen Williams has given off some Scottie Pippen vibes, emerging as a Pippen-esque scorer, playmaker, and defender. Even Gilgeous Alexander has some headroom. His season was sensational. One of the greatest seasons that's ever been had by a player, Holmgren said. Some final accolades. First player to be named the regular season MVP and win the NBA championship in the same season since Steph Curry in the 2014-2015 season. First player to be named the regular season MVP and the finals MVP in the same season since LeBron James in the 2012-2013 season. First player to win the NBA scoring title and the NBA championship since Shaquille O'Neal in the 1999-2000 season. 6 years after Oklahoma City made a big bet on him, Gilgeous Alexander has paid it off and then some. Presti built the team, Gilgeous Alexander led it, and now there is an NBA champion in Oklahoma. A young champion, a hungry champion. Dynasties are supposed to be dead in the NBA. Its death may be exaggerated. And again, that Sports Illustrated online feature is entitled Thunder Finally Make It to the Mountaintop with Plans to Stay After First NBA Title, written by Chris Mannix. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.